Hello, welcome to the Citywire Funds Fanatic podcast. My name is Gavin Lumsden, and today I'm talking to a real veteran of the investment trust scene, Peter Spiller, founder and chief investment officer of CG Asset Management. Peter, very good to see you.
Good morning, Gavin. Lovely to see you.
Okay. Now, Peter, you're best known for having run Capital Gearing Trust since 1982. That makes you one of the longest serving fund managers in the UK, although I think Simon Knott at Rights and Issues pips you to the post on the absolute longest. Still, 38 years is a long time. Can you tell us a bit about Capital Gearing Trust? Because I know it's one of a small band of defensive trusts that aim to protect investors' money. But how do you put it? How do you explain it?
Well, Capital Gearing Trust is simply described as, in concept, implying an investment process which allows it to look after all of someone's financial assets, for instance, mine. And it would appeal, we hope, to people who have similar characteristics or risk requirements to my own. That is to say, it attempts to outperform equity markets over time, but also to avoid losing money. To have very low risk of substantial drawdowns. So over the last 38 years, we have had 1 year when we had a drawdown, which was 2%. That was back when sterling was very strong and there was a taper tantrum in bonds. The other 37 years have all been up. Over those 38 years, the share price has gone up 200 times. So we hope that we've established with some credibility our ability to produce good returns, but taking rather below average risk.
Okay. And this year, that risk-controlled approach has been successful as well. While the FTSE All-Share, the UK stock market, has been tumbling 18%, your shares are up, CGT, Capital Gearing shares, are up 2.7% up to 27th of July, and the underlying asset value is up a little bit more than that. So can you tell us a bit about the portfolio? What are you invested in to produce that kind of small gain when equity markets are having such a tough time?
Well, we have different pillars to our asset allocation. So our principle, I should just back off and say, is that where an asset class has high prospective returns and low risk, we want to earn a lot of it, and we want to earn it with long duration. The converse is also true, that where prospective returns are poor and risk is high, we want to earn very little of it. And what we do earn, we want to be of short duration if we can thus organize it. So we have felt for some time that equity markets were looking very rich. On top of that, we were quite lucky in a way, because in at the turn of the year, a number of stocks and sectors got very frothy indeed. So one of those would have been renewable infrastructure. Where around Christmas, it was just astonishing that the level of premium that these things went to. They had some very good long-term attractions. Although, actually, in that particular case, we were quite concerned that the market was using forecasts for power prices that were much more optimistic than our own forecasts. So we sold all those. And we also saw various stocks that we like a lot for the long term. So like Castellum and Investor and Grainger all go to very high ratings relative to their history. And we sold a third of each of those. So the result of that is that we went into the end of February with just 30% in risk assets. And that felt uncomfortably low, I have to say. But obviously in March, it felt uncomfortably high. In March, we put 10% to work. So we moved to 40% risk assets. Not more, but we still have plenty of dry powder. That was because we thought values were improving a lot, which is why we raised the weighting. But we didn't think they'd improve to a compelling level. And therefore, by definition, still don't. We had, fortunately, asset classes which were offsetting this. So TIPS, for instance, in the United States, that's inflation protected securities that are issued by the government. Real interest rates were falling. Interest rates generally were falling. And they worked very well to offset the falls in equities. Because one of the interesting features about equities, which we have talked about for some time, is that if the S&P falls dramatically, there is nowhere to hide. Correlations go to one in equities, including in what we regard as very defensive stocks, which allowed us to buy at substantial discount what we believe to be very high quality of cash flow companies. So that worked out quite well. So all in all, we got very lucky the results have been satisfactory.
Okay, Peter, yeah, absolutely. So Peter, you're it's a multi-asset fund. You're holding equities, and included in the equities is quite a lot of holdings in investment trusts. You like buying investment trusts on discounts when they're undervalued. And then you've got these big holdings in US government bonds, inflation-linked ones, the TIPS you mentioned. How much do you have in gold? Because gold has done very well, and that's a classic sort of defensive investment for your kinds of funds. Is gold a big asset class for you?
Of course, the straight answer is we have 2.5%, which is actually significantly less than a number of people who have similar number of funds that have similar objectives to ours. Obviously, gold has been a great performer over the last couple of months.
It's up nearly 25% this year. Early this week, getting close to $2,000 an ounce. So,
It is.
But you're not a gold bug.
It is astonishing.
Why is that?
Well, I do like gold. Don't get me wrong. But I have significant reservations, which I'll get to in a second. And we look at gold as a in comparison with TIPS. So actually, if you put up a chart of long TIPS, the 2050 TIPS and gold, they're very, very tightly correlated. And we have much preferred TIPS as a way of defending against inflation. So we think inflation will get dramatically higher. I won't talk about that in a second. But so you have the choice, but we much prefer an asset where we can make analysis to one where we can't. But we did try and look at some analytics on gold. So for instance, for me, a very important feature is that gold is always supposed, the great virtue of gold is always supposed to be that it holds its real value. And so we said, okay, well, let's go and have a look and see what that real value was over history. And so we went back as far as we could with a free market. So Nixon closed the gold window in 1971. So obviously it was a controlled price at that stage. But we thought, okay, we'll give it a couple of years to get established and look at August 1973. So I'm pretty sure that August 1973 was a pretty favorable time for the gold price. The inflation was pretty high. There was a free market. And as it happens, it was about $100. And so we applied the CPI in America since then to that price to get some sort of feel. So I don't want to be precise here, but some sort of feel for roughly what is that long-term value, that the real value of gold that prevails. And it's a little under $600 an ounce. So it's a big premium to that. There are good reasons why it's at a premium to that. But I think it has become much more speculative than tips. We own tips and other index-linked government bonds in roughly a 10-to-1 relationship to gold. So gold is great. I think that the time when gold does better than tips is if people start to think we might lose everything. So the financial system is collapsing, or it might not. It doesn't have to be even in the West. So if there was political instability in China, for instance, a lot of Chinese people have made a lot of money. If they all decided to put 10% just as a hedge into gold, the price would be very high indeed. So it's really a continuum of risk. I think tips, in my assessment, is probably a better defense against inflation. But if you're talking about losing everything, or much more extreme circumstances, then gold probably does better.
That's very interesting, Peter. So in terms of crises, where do you feel we are with this crisis? Is this it's a different kind of crisis, obviously, from the 2008-2009 financial crisis. Do you feel is it severe or just different?
Well, I think that
the gold did very well in the banking crisis.
It did. But it can also fall back. You only have to reflect on the history of gold since it was became a free market in 1971. To recall that in 1980, I think it was, it hit $850. And then we got to what's known in the market as the Gordon Brown low, where the UK sold all its gold at $250. There was plenty of inflation between the two. It sure didn't hold its value then. But in terms of how big a crisis we're in, I think it's been a continuum, really, since the late 1990s, or even the mid-1990s, when Greenspan began to adopt his very accommodative monetary policies. And in doing so, encouraged the rise of debt. And he felt fully justified in his policies by the fact that inflation did not develop as many had forecasted it would with that monetary background, but nevertheless, excessive levels of debt led to the crisis in 2008-2009, and that problem was solved by more debt, fiscal deficits and monetary printing, QE. In the 10 years since, we have seen monetary policy again with a huge bias towards ease, and debt increasing ever more. And we had the odd situation, so even before the virus began, where in a reflection, I think, of Hyman Minsky's theories. So Minsky, you'll recall, said that when you have long periods of stability, it encourages more and more speculative behavior and therefore breeds its own instability. And I think a very similar thing has happened to inflation. So the constraint on monetary policy and on fiscal policy has always been fear of developing inflation. And you have to be quite old, Gavin, to well over 50, I'd say, to have experienced as an adult and involved in the investment world, to have experienced inflation as a problem. It's always been in the background, but it has not been a problem. And So we had the really extraordinary situation, in our view anyway, that before the virus struck, we had a fully employed economy in America, huge amounts of debt, a fiscal deficit of over 5% of GDP, and Congress and the White House were talking together about putting together an infrastructure fund to be paid for with printed money to develop the infrastructure of America, which surely needs spending. But nevertheless, what that showed was that the fear of inflation had completely evaporated from the minds of policymakers.
So do you think we've all been lulled into a massive sense of complacency because of these decades of lower inflation and we're just relying on forces of deflation or disinflation to kind of keep that down? But and now the governments and central banks around the world, following the coronavirus, in responding to the situation, they're taking their intervention to a new level. So, and you've been commenting on how this, you know, there was a big blurring of monetary and fiscal policy going on in the various measures being taken. Do you see, you've referred to, you're talking about inflation, did you see that a surge in inflation being the biggest threat from this blurring
it's interesting the word threat. So it's a threat to your money and mine, but it actually is, I think, part of the solution to excessive debt, because when debt is as excessive as it currently is, there are only essentially two ways to resolve it. And it's already at levels where I think it is a very big constraint on growth going forward. So it has to be resolved. And there are only two ways to resolve it. One is a lot of it gets defaulted upon, which is what happened in the 30s. So it normally involves depression. And the other is what's called financial repression, which is to say elevated levels of inflation associated with interest rates that are far below that level of inflation. So in other words, the value of the debt is inflated away. And that has to go on, in my assessment, for long enough to bring the real value of debt into a better relationship with assets and incomes in the real economy. The extent of the inflation is really difficult to call. You can achieve that end either by an extended period of reasonably elevated inflation combined with low rates, or by a shorter period of very high inflation, and that would obviously achieve it much quicker. So if you look after situation after the war, obviously almost every country had very high debt, government debt after the war. And in France, they had really very elevated inflation, 50%, that sort of thing. And within 5 years, their ratios were wonderful. So we were much more moderate, of course. We had a long period of financial repression, but nothing as extreme as that. So it took us to the end of the 70s to get to the same situation as they'd achieved in 1950. And it's interesting because French growth was actually much better than the UK's after that period, after 1950. Who knows what's better for the economy? But what's for sure is that we do not want very elevated levels of inflation from a society's point of view. So 15%.
Peter, I might be falling into the trap of being complacent, but you've been talking about this need for inflation, and therefore the threat to inflation at some point. You've been talking about this for some time, and it leads you to manage and position capital gearing in the way that you've described, and that's been very successful. Avoiding the big falls in stock markets and participating in some of the gains. So that's all very good, but in terms of the inflation, the genie hasn't escaped the bottle yet, right, in the way that you've described. How could we be sure that it will, and that you'll be right?
Okay, so the first thing to say, Gavin, is we can't be sure of anything. that there is no precedent for the situation that we're currently in. I was just talking up till then, not about the evidence that inflation is going to develop shortly, but about the consequences. So the evidence is quite interesting. So the first thing to say is that one of the reasons why Greenspan was able to produce, and his successors were able to produce very easy monetary policy without inflationary consequences, was globalization. So I think it was the IMF who suggested that globalization had not 1% off the inflation rate in Western countries. For each of the last 20-25 years. So that's been a factor which is, at a minimum, not going to be helpful going forward, and looks as though it's going to go in reverse. Because even before the virus struck, globalization, defined as the percentage of trade relative to world GDP, was falling. And everything we've seen subsequently from the relationship of the US, particularly in China, but also the very pronounced emphasis on protectionism in one form or another of the reaction of countries to the virus. So I think that's one element that will go the other way. The other is that the scale of the response is completely different from 2008, 2009. In 2008, 2009, the governments had big deficits for a year, and then they clawed it back. I don't think that's going to be true this time. So we had austerity. I think there isn't a word on the planet which has less relevance to our future than austerity, to our immediate future. Than austerity, because it is not advocated by anybody, not by academia. Actually, it's not completely true of academia, but of almost the consensus of academia. Certainly, the media are forever warning. The FT, for instance, if you read that weekly, you know, that there's no stimulus that they haven't approved of. And among politicians, we hear from our own in Boris that we're not going to get austerity. I think it's plain we're just not going to get austerity, you know, whoever runs America, particularly. Not only that, but there is a requirement for a lot of fiscal stimulus, because looking forward, if history is any guide, savings rates will be quite elevated. At personal savings rates, that is. And it seems likely that corporates, with the excessive debt they already have and the scare that they've had, will be very slow to spend money on CapEx. And so we have a situation that Keynes would have recognized in the 30s, where you've got a demand shortfall. And that will be made up, I'm fairly confident, by governments. So it isn't just that we're going to have extraordinary deficits this year. So they're generally forecast to be about 17% of GDP for the Western world. I don't think that we will see anything like a contraction in those deficits that we saw after the 2008-09 crisis.
Okay, so Peter, it sounds like it could be different this time. Could you tell us a bit more about the TIPS, the US index linked inflation linked government bonds that you've been buying, and because that's the main defense that you have against this rising mm-hmm. inflation. I think some people would be listening to this might think, you know, government bonds, US government bonds, long dated ones, you know, what kind of return are you getting off them? You know, interest rates and yields have come down such a long way. What do TIPS
right.
give
so,
you?
So you're absolutely right that we have had a wonderful run in TIPS. So of course we keep asking ourselves the question, should we continue to own them? The specific answer to your question is that for 10 years, it's minus one real, and for 30 years, it's minus 0.3. And it is a measure of how difficult it's going to be to preserve the real value of assets that we believe there is significant capital gain to be made in TIPS from those already record low yields. And the reason for that comes back to the financial repression that I was talking about before, that it's pretty clear that a matter of policy, that if we get the inflation, so that's another argument, which I think we will, that's certainly not a consensus view. But if we get the inflation, that nominal rates will still remain very low, and therefore real rates will be substantially negative. And therefore, we think that there will be a significant further capital gain, even from here. It's been a wonderful run. We've been very much enjoying it. But
so just to understand the basics, so the negative yield on those TIPS that you just mentioned, that means that you bought them at a price which will mean if the price at which they were redeemed at eventually will be lower than the price you paid.
Not in nominal terms. In real terms, it will be. As indeed, it will be the price of the of nominal treasuries or gilts or whatever. They will fall in real terms, even if you pay no tax on the income. So that is the world we are in.
I see. So they're low returning at the moment, but if you're right, their value will increase because their returns are linked to inflation.
The risk-free rate, so to speak, will get more negative in real terms. That could mean that the treasuries do quite poorly because you can still keep rates well below inflation, but well above where they are today. We are very cautious indeed about long-term nominal government bonds.
Okay. Well, thank you for the explanation on the government bonds there. I wonder if we can turn back to equities, because a lot of our listeners, you know, invest in your investment trust, but they invest in other investment trusts. I think they'd be interested to know, you know, what you were buying in March, the dark days of March when there was a big sell-off. You had some cash in your pocket, quite a lot, and you'd taken some profits. You'd taken some profits in these industrial holding companies like Investor AB and Castellum. And they're both Swedish companies. What's the attraction about them? And were you buying back into them having...
Investor, yes. Castellum, not really. But the attractions of Sweden are... Actually, I should back off and just say a more general theme has been that... we recognize two factors which are developing, or two themes which are developing. One, obviously, is that the cost of capital has gone down, risk-free capital has gone down. And the other is that, in our view, the riskiness of the structure of the economy has gone up. Therefore, the risk of equities has gone up. But if you can buy companies which have secure cash flows, which are in some sense or in some form inflation linked, then we think the values of those will rise if they are secure. They do prove to be secure. So what we were buying was largely on that theme. So take, for example, a company like Tritax Big Box. They have warehouses which are let to good credits for 14 years on average. And their tenants have put a lot of money into their the machinery inside their warehouses. So there's every incentive for them to stay there, even when that thing come to an end. So essentially what you're looking at is a credit portfolio. If these companies can stay solvent, then the rents will be paid, and the rents are inflation adjusted. So the biggest client is Amazon. We have every hope that Amazon is credit worthy. Hope that proves correct, or it'll be very expensive for a lot of people. They sold off absolutely with the market. As I say, in sell-offs, correlations go to one, because you don't have any choice. If you want to take money out of the market, you don't have any choice about what you sell. You have to sell what you've got. I mean, that's just as simple as that. And I think that's probably why correlations go to one. But anyway, they did sell off to a very big discount to their asset value. We started buying them too soon. They fell another 20% after we started buying, but we carried on buying. And they're now back up roughly to asset values. It's a good 50% off the bottom. So that's been great. The attractions of Sweden, apart from the others, I culturally like Sweden. So this is real prejudice, but I love.
Do you have a personal connection? Family connection?
But I just love the fact that when you talk to people who run Swedish companies, if I could just tell a brief anecdote, there's a splendid woman who runs a property company there. And she said, I have this real problem when I meet American hedge funds. They say, what's your performance fee? And she says, I don't have one. And they say, why do you try? And she says, because that's my job. I try very hard indeed. The corporate culture in Sweden is one I think is just much more attractive than the American corporate culture, which is so short term and share price orientated that I think is not constructive for the long term. But also the Swedish currency is extremely cheap. It's been performing actually rather well for us this year, but remains extremely cheap because it has to remain competitive with Germany. And the currency of Germany has been kept down by its membership of the euro, which trades at a level which reflects the issues of the eurozone as a whole rather than Germany. So it is extremely cheap. It's very well run. The fiscal policy tends to be very responsible, so I think it's a very attractive currency. But on top of that, if you take a stock like Castellum, the appeal of Castellum was exactly as before, that it had gently rising in real terms rents, which were extremely reliable, and it's financed. So this is a key point that people who invest in investment trusts will... Excuse me just a second. The people who invest in investment trusts will recognize that investment trusts develop an NAV with the debt, the prior charges, at fair value. And if you look at companies in actually in a lot of large parts of the world, but particularly in Germany and Sweden, where interest rates are very low, the debt side is very cheap. They're paying negative real rates typically. And so if you can own assets that rise even gently in real terms, but have financing at negative real rates, then the position looks pretty attractive for the medium term. So I should emphasize that we think returns from every asset, looking forward for the next 10 years on our models, the S&P will produce roughly zero. This is all in real terms. The S&P will produce roughly zero, maybe we think the UK and Japan are a bit cheaper than that, and probably did producing rather better, but very, very immodest levels of prospective return. If we're right about inflation, it won't be nearly as good as zero.
It's a very bearish outlook, isn't it? I'm just going back to the investment trust side of things. You were faced with probably lots and lots of potential bargains back in March. Some investors have been complaining. For example, I've been speaking to investors at Myton and Hawksmoor, complaining that they bought investment trusts when their share prices were trading on very wide discounts during March. But that those discounts and some of those trusts haven't narrowed during the rebound. So in other words, the share prices have, have not been participating as much in the recovery as they would have liked, and so therefore hurting their returns. Do you agree, or did you suffer
David,
that problem?
I don't know what they've bought. I really can't comment on that. But the interesting thing about March was that after a long period, so investment trusts used to offer terrific opportunities for discount arbitrage, for want of a better word, and the those opportunities were very rare in the 3 or 4 years leading up to the end of 2019. In March, there were some signs that the discounts, but it's starting to offer some opportunities, and we bought some things. We bought actually 9 or 10 different situations, and many of which I won't mention if you don't mind, because we're continuing to buy them, but they're not very liquid. But actually, it hasn't been our experience that they haven't bounced. So, among things we bought, which were a little more liquid, was Witten. So Witten went out to a 15 discount. I think Witten is pretty well run. It traded somewhere around 4 or 5 for a long time before 2019, and in fact, I'm afraid we try not to take a very short-term view, but they bounced and we were able to sell them on a 3 discount. So that was obviously quite satisfactory because the assets have bounced a lot too. The sell-off was very brief. And what I have observed about investment trusts is that in bear markets, it's really towards the end of bear markets that you get the best opportunities, because I think in a sense people sell on their assessment of what the asset value will be next week rather than today, if you know what I mean. And at the end of bear markets, that assessment is always that it will be down. So they don't mind if they have to take a rather larger discount because they think it will be a small discount to the assets as they actually develop. But that's just speculation. I mean, but the fact is that as bear markets develop, the opportunities tend to get better, and this was too brief. We had a V-shaped recovery in the equity market, and so that psychology never really developed. But there were a number of opportunities, and what we always like is. And our ideal investment is one where you buy at a large discount and have assurance from the structure that discount will disappear over time. So, for instance, where the company will offer to buy back shares at NAV at specified periods, those sort of things. If you can buy those at large discounts and their assets which are properly run. That's obviously extremely attractive.
Well, that's interesting you say that, Peter, because actually, whether it was a brief sell-off or not, it was obviously a very severe one. But it seems to be, of course, a revival of activism or investor engagement, call it what you will. But there's a number of investors, well, a couple of ones I've just mentioned already, who are pressing boards of investment trusts to do more in the direction you're talking about. to narrow the gap between the shares and the discount, the gap between the shares and the net asset value. You've spoken out about one particular case, Gabelli Value, North American Equities Trust, which has been performing badly, and some shareholders and the board want there to be a continuation vote and want the vote to be negative for the trust to discontinue. Why do you think, but the manager has, or an associate of the fund manager has a large stake and doesn't want to do that. So you think it's a bit of a test case, don't you, for corporate governance?
Well, it's interesting. Corporate governance, we have been involved with all the time I've been running money. But until the end of last year, it has always been behind closed doors, having chats with the chairman and the board and that sort of thing. Or sometimes at the AGM, but it doesn't normally get reported. The reason for that is that we don't think it's our role to embarrass people. And in fact, if people are embarrassed, they find it much more difficult to change because it looks as though they're changing under pressure. We have always found it much more effective to talk to people on a friendly basis about what we think would benefit them and in doing so, benefit us. And corporate governance has become much more prominent as of interest to journalists, for instance, like yourself, Gavin, just in the last year or so. But it's still, I think, the weak sister in the ESG trilogy, if trilogies can have sisters. But remember. And it's very interesting. So investment trusts, if you'll permit me to talk for a second, is a movement to which I owe a great deal. But much of the record of capital gearing has been built on investment trusts. And I want it to prosper. But it has suffered really badly from changes in regulation of one kind or another, whether it's Basel II or MiFID or whatever, with the result that there are probably 300 trusts which have no relevance going forward to the role that they should play or were set up to play.
That's a big. Sorry to interrupt, Peter. That's a big number. 300. There's only around 400 or so investment trusts that are members of the Trade Body Association of Investment Companies. So you're talking by number. That's three quarters of the industry.
So that sounds dreadful. But the reason for it is that the among other things, liquidity it has been very much impacted by regulatory change. But the requirement for liquidity has been driven up by regulatory change. And the result of that is that, I mean, people have different estimates, but it's that a trust, other than very highly specialized trusts, there are exceptions, but as a broad statement, people with standard kind of portfolios, you really need to be something quite close to 500 million in market cap to be relevant. Unless you have a ZDM, so a zero discount model, which would allow people to buy and sell in size because providing the underlying assets are liquid, there is no limit to how many shares you can buy or sell in a zero discount trust.
So just to explain to some of our listeners, Peter, so a zero discount policy is a policy by which you're either issuing shares or buying them back to ensure that the share price is as close as possible to the underlying net asset value, because some of the problems we're talking about are where, you know, there's a big discounts or big premiums occur with the share price being either a long way below or a long way above the actual asset value. And you've been running that policy for 5 years.
So it's been, I think, very beneficial for the trust. Not least, of course, because it's grown quite nicely. The market cap when I started in 82 was around 500,000, and it's now a little over 500 million. 520. So it's 1,000 times bigger. But we adopted it because we wanted to avoid the premium that we sometimes went on to, because I always felt responsible to the shareholders that we had, and if someone paid 12-15% premium, there was a stage back in the 80s when it went to a 200% premium, but I'm happy to say they've outperformed if they've kept it, but outperformed the index. But we couldn't do anything to protect those people. If the premium stuffed off and they lost 10% of their money, they probably were quite cross. But we couldn't do anything to protect them. But the concept behind it is exactly as you say, that every day we offer to anyone who wants to either to buy shares from us from the trust at a very small premium, or to sell them back to us at a very small discount. So that makes sure the price is always.
It's a neat solution.
Yeah, I think it works very well.
Yeah, it's a neat solution, Peter. But I suppose the risk for some of these investment trusts that you're talking about, the smaller ones, is that if they haven't got their proposition correct, if the investor demand isn't there, and they start buying back the shares and they just keep buying back the shares, they shrink away to nothing. And so it's a high risk strategy, isn't it, for a smaller investor?
Well, I would argue not.
To grow. But you're saying they should.
I would argue not. Because, anyway. First of all, it's the only way they can grow. But secondly, rather more contentiously, if seriously no one wants their money run by them, then what role are they playing? I mean, they have no viable trust to begin with. I don't think the risk is high. If you're already out of the game, then it's a gamble where you can win, but I'd say you can't really lose, because if that really is the circumstance, you should wind up anyway. But the history has been very much biased towards success. So there have been trusts which have not very many trusts which have adopted this, but more and more people are thinking about it. And there tends to be a bit of a J curve. So there are people who've owned it when it was at a discount, who are just grateful to get out at asset value or close to asset value to begin with. But they haven't been huge historically. It's been very interesting how successful this strategy has been. So long as, of course, the key thing is that they believe that mechanism will be maintained, sustained. So there has been a big problem with some trusts, which again I think is a real problem for corporate governance, where promises have been made that the discount will not go to more than 5 or 10%, whatever it might be, but they haven't been kept. And once you haven't kept it, then you're in big trouble, because no one believes anything you say.
Mm. It's interesting. Is the investment trust sector, does it have to be judged by higher standards than elsewhere? Because, you know, one of the great advantages that we're often told about investment trusts is this independent board of non-executive directors that they have, or most have. But you're highlighting, nonetheless, that there are, you know, numerous problems with the sector, basically being populated by too many small trusts that haven't really got.
Yes, well, I mean, that situation has developed relatively recently. So I think that is. So I don't want to be too critical of boards, but it is peculiar to me. I find it just interesting that the boards of investment trusts are so much less ambitious than the boards of practically every other operating company. So operating companies, the thrust of board meetings as a general statement is, how do we grow? And it's unique among companies that people think they've done a good job if they just hand it on the same as it was when they took it over, having been run competently and honestly. I would say that's a poverty of ambition.
So you've mentioned the hurdle rate of a hurdle of £500 million as being a decent size of investment trust mm-hmm. that will have a viable future, and all the wealth managers will want to potentially put it on their buy lists and that sort of thing. That's a level that you're about to reach if you've not reached already after this year's performance.
But in our case,
just over £500 million.
Just to repeat, if you have a ZDM, then the liquidity problem goes out of the window, providing that you have a liquid portfolio underneath that you can fulfill.
Because you're always there to buy. The board is always there to buy the shares.
Yes, absolutely.
If nobody else is. Yeah. So somebody can always sell.
And that is the key.
There are so many trusts below £500 million. Do you think there needs to be a lot more corporate activity, mergers and bids to bring similar trusts together in combination?
I mean, the broad answer to that is yes. It has been a real surprise to me that we haven't had more consolidation. Without naming names, but even where houses have two trusts that are essentially identical, but there seems to be very little appetite among boards to consolidate thus far, so as far as we know. So I hope that the conversations going on within the boards are more constructive than I'm sounding. It is a surprise, because actually, as a whole, I think that the directors of investment trusts are high quality people. It has been suggested that the reason why they don't consolidate is that their own jobs might be at risk, least in the short term, they enjoy being directors and so forth. But actually, I think that's not right. I have more faith in the quality of people that make up boards, and I just think it's the zeitgeist has not quite got there. But there are a lot of pressures, so. Brokers, investment banks, are certainly in some cases that I'm aware of becoming reluctant to take on trusts that have no viability and no plan to solve it. I think that there will be significantly more. I think we are in the middle of significantly more pressure to rationalize the trust business and make it more relevant to the people we're here to serve. We're all here to serve, as it were, the surgeon in Oxford, who is a very good surgeon and has less interest in investment, but nevertheless wants his money run professionally.
It's interesting. There seems to be a mood for this. I was speaking to Nick Greenwood at Myton recently, and his Global Opportunities Trust, as you know, invests in a lot of heavily discounted trusts and closed-end funds, and we were talking a bit about Numis Securities this month published a report basically calling for or making the case for more consolidation within the sector along the lines you're talking about, three quarters of the sector roughly being subscale, arguably, or not sufficiently large to command the attention of wealth managers, the stockbrokers, who are the main buyers in bulk of investment trust shares. And we've seen more evidence of at Gabelli and other places. RDL Realization, formerly known as Ranger Direct, a loan company, that's one that you've had issues with. You actually had to. I was reading your annual report. You had to sue them on behalf of the zero shareholders.
Well, we didn't actually sue them, but we retained a QC. And his opinions.
Okay. But, well, you had to get quite legally heavy with them.
To weigh quite heavily. It's interesting. So I read a paper actually, which is very similar to the Numis commentary, which you've probably read. It's available on our website if anyone wants to read it, about ESG. And very interestingly, I had a conversation last week with John Gabelli. Mario Gabelli, I should say. Sorry, Mario Gabelli, in New York. He's absolutely on side. He says he totally agrees with all the comments made there.
Oh, that's interesting. So he's the founder of the fund manager of the company. So that sounds like he's not supportive of continuing
I shouldn't put words in his mouth. I'm not putting it in, but he just was expressing great sympathy with the analysis that I was putting forward. So I think times are changing. You know, I think I do recommend the Numis article to anyone who's interested in this subject. You know, it's very good.
Yes, so times are changing. Let's have a quick word about your business, because it strikes me that the growth that you've seen in Capital Gearing Trust since you introduced that zero discount policy that we've been talking about, that's gone in hand also with the growth in your business, CG Asset Management. And you've been planning the succession, your eventual retirement, but you've got a team around you, and you've passed on the chief executiveship to Alistair Lang. So, what? How much longer do you want to be in the business? So you've stepped back as the number one, but you're the chief investment officer. What are your plans?
I should just back up a second, saying about what we did. So I've given this fund, or the majority of this of the management company, now belongs to an employee ownership trust, which is like John Lewis. So it's or Waitrose. The reason for that is that I've worked for companies and I've worked for partnerships, or been a partner. I have no doubt which works better, which is partnerships, because they tend to have a much longer view and are more committed to supporting their clients and so forth. So we've tried to replicate the economics of that as much as we can. So the ownership is dominated by the workforce. And one consequence of that is that it won't be taken over, or at least very unlikely to be. So that so often happens to boutiques that work out well. They just get bought out by a big firm. And that's very nice for the founders and so forth, but on the whole, not so great for the clients, in my observation. And as the principals of our firm are the client comes first, is the first one. And the second one is don't be greedy, and the third is have fun. And the last is may explain why I have enthusiasm for staying in office for as long as I can. So you asked me what I want.
So you're still having fun, Peter.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this situation is absolutely fascinating. I would like to see out the full circle. So we had some very easy Keynesian policies, which led to developing inflation in the late 60s. That got much worse in the late 70s, and then everything crashed as the inflation got out of hand. When the inflation got so high that it became a political problem itself, and as previously mentioned, that level of inflation had purged balance sheets, so debt had been markedly reduced in real terms. That produced fantastic opportunities in '82 when I started. PEs were 7 and 8 for quality companies, and it was balance sheets were in great shape. It was wonderful. And I'm sort of kind of hopeful that we'll go through that same thing again. Now, that took perhaps 12 years of it.
I see. So you're planning to stay around for your thesis to be proven, and then step back and take the credit from all your grateful shareholders.
Well, what I'd really like to do is get through that period, which I hope be less than the 12 years that took, roughly, or perhaps 14. Just sit back and watch Alistair and Chris and whoever else we've taken on by that stage take advantage of the fabulous opportunities to produce 50% returns each year that we were doing in those days, and as opposed to the very mundane opportunities we have at the moment, which is where the ambition is to produce is really to preserve the real value of investment and hopefully a little bit more. So it remains fascinating, this thing.
Yes, in that scenario, I expect Capital Gearing would actually own a lot more shares and equities than it has done for a very long time, like it did when you first took over it 38 years ago. Peter, thanks very much for regarding both your outlook and your career and your business. But meantime, thanks very much for
Thank you, Gavin.
Talking to me.